Okay, this is Bob and Cameron once again, and I've got to look up what number episode this is.
Around 37,
38.
Maybe even 38.
Right, so let's just go over to the archive and bring it up here. Take a few seconds. Such a huge archive, 33,000 hours of discussion with you-know-who. So it takes a long time for the inventory of articles. We are doing a very good series for the Finnegan's Wake Reading Group. So there's a good Facebook forum doing Finnegan's Wake, and a lot of fun to read all the different people. So our contribution is that we get Ion to pick a page, and then I start reading it, and he tells us what it means today. He relates it to events today. The words adapts to the present, and it's pretty uncanny what he does, or they do, and the order of pages, I think we're up to like 24, 25 episodes, 25 pages, is the proper order of the pages in the book. You get that? It starts with page 44. The real beginning of the book is page 44 with the ballad. And then he goes up and down the book for page 2, page 3, page 4. So, pretty radical presentation. And that's available here at Ion and Bob for you to listen to those sessions. They're pretty unique. It's a new way to look at the Finnegan's Wake, how it, quote, prophetically talks about today. So, let's see, 23rd of September, what's it going to say?
Hey, Cameron and Bob are back with the 37th episode of our examination.
This is the 38th episode. Oh, we got that established, and I told a nice story. So, what were you going to say? You were starting to say something, do you remember?
Yes, I was going to say that big point of the book seems to be the relationship between Trump and the tech body. But I, for one, don't understand what it is that you see in that regard. There's a tetrad on Trump at the bottom of page 174.
Right.
And that possibly is a way to get into that.
Okay, so, well, on page 172 begins the last section, chapter 6, the tech body and President Donald Trump. And I go, now we come to the point of this essay. And I have a quote from page 11, take today. It is man who has become both figure and ground via the electrotechnical extension of his awareness. So in Playboy, or in 69, he was talking about the content as ground, one passing sentence, and he put content in italics, and he said we're going to have to look at the content as ground. He didn't say ground, but that seemed to me what he was pointing out, because he was probably writing this with Barry. I know they wrote it from 68 to 71, 72. So when information completely takes over, and the mixed corporate media have fused to a pure software, can't find the hardware, then the content becomes the ground. So it says here, it is man who has become both figure and ground via the electrotechnical extension of awareness. So the White House, from that point on, was the ground, figure and ground, this phenomenon.
Well, let's not go too fast here. Let's try and figure out what's going on with this citation from Take Today.
Right.
I think you're bringing up the content as ground is maybe a good way to get into this. The distinguishing feature of the Gutenberg Galaxy is that it doesn't maintain the distinction between figure and ground. It loses ground.
Yes.
Right? So it becomes only figure that it takes to be both figure and ground.
Right.
That's the point at the end of perspective, right?
Yeah.
So then you can say that in the Gutenbergian perspective, content is ground. But in that flip, ground as ground has disappeared.
Yeah.
So yeah. Then when he says that it is man who has become both figure and ground, we have to figure out, is he talking there from a Gutenbergian perspective, or is he talking there from an electric tactile perspective? And I think he's saying the latter. I think he's saying that he is both figure and ground, but not as identical.
Right.
Not such that figure and ground are the same. Rather, that human beings, because they're finite, because they're always limited, can never be more than a finite, delimited figure. But they're related to ground, which is figures plural.
Yes.
Right. So when he says both figure and ground, what he's saying is that, or at least what I think he's saying, is that in an electrotechnical environment, we are instantaneously exposed to all possible figures, but the all possible figures is ground.
Yep. Well, maybe right? The one you select is ground. The one that
pressures you to select. No, that's Gutenberg. That's Gutenberg.
It doesn't stay ground very long.
Pardon me?
The tactility is the rapidity of shift from it's ground for a second, then it isn't.
Yeah, but you see, you have to ask yourself, it's ground for a second, then it isn't. That has two different meanings.
Yeah.
You're caching that at the level of history, at the level of everyday experience. But at the level of ground, the figure that's ground for a second is in a different time. That it's like the difference between the table of chemical elements and their expression in the world. Their expression in the world is always momentary. Everything in the world is changing second by second by second. But the elementary table is not changing. But what you can do is you can put your finger on hydrogen, and then you can put your finger on helium, and you can say, well, this was ground for that second, this was ground for another second, and you can go right through the table up to 120 or whatever the number is now.
Mm.
Those are two very, very different things.
Well, I'm not sure I know what you mean, but I took this to mean the second case, the electric tactility, this figure-ground relationship. And so he talked about the word making the market, and the word came out of the White House or its associates like the Federal Reserve, and that was the ground. But the ground of visual space, maybe. So each space, sensory space, had its own spatial dimension, and they're all flipping into each out. I mean, it's a page of Finnegan's Wake, always flipping in and out, and you don't know which is which.
Correct.
But the Gutenberg split figure and ground, and then McLuhan said, "Well, figure and ground merge under electrical conditions." So the medium became the message, and the message became the medium.
Right, but don't say that as if the gap disappeared, or as if tactility disappeared.
Right,
they're they merge. There's two very different kinds of merging. There's Gutenbergian merging that merges at the point of perspective. And then there's electric merging, which is a natural condition, and which, once it was discovered, that natural condition led from somewhere around 1800, led to where we are today with all of the different applications of electricity. But the those applications of electricity depend upon the difference between the negative and the positive poles. There is no such thing as electric merging that does not pass through the gate in between those poles.
Yeah. Yep. It's a discontinuity. It's an abrupt interface. People,
correct.
The effect of electric technologies in the understanding media days was it created flux and flow. But people, they maybe Gutenbergized it with New Age philosophies, you know, go with the flow. And they didn't recognize that tactility had a lot of contrast. So more and more contrast was coming on people. So flow was a misnomer for actual overlaying, interdependent, imminent blur, but momentary clarities, which you would soon forget.
Right. Yeah, it's just like people said then and people say now, the voyage is the destination. Right? So New Age philosophy and cheap philosophy, like the voyage is the destination, these are attempts to consolidate what can't be consolidated.
Yeah.
So we're always lying to ourselves.
Yes. The overall big phrase for this problem is whatever.
Yeah. That's right. And McLuhan actually, where is that? All as we're talking, I'll try and find where McLuhan says something like that 70 or 75 years ago.
Well, while you say that, he talked about where it's at. He made a lot of interesting probes around where it's at. And I think in Take Today, he has where it's at, AT&T, you know, it, ITT became AT&T.
That's very good. I like that a lot.
Yeah, that's in there somewhere, one page.
Yeah.
But the whatever is our time after McLuhan. The people, they don't care where it's at. Just tell them one. Just give them one. Send them there that you say is where it's at, and they'll go there because it's whatever. There really, really is. William Irwin Thompson talked about the victim of our time was the mind. He went through the history of culture, and each phase had a victim. If I remember, the animal was victim in the first one, then woman was the victim in the next one, then religion around the industrial, you know, 500 years ago, religion was the next victim, and then something, not sure, but the last one was the victim was the mind. That would be the left hemisphere mind, I guess, or maybe both. The deeper you go into it, you get into the 70s, both left and right hemispheres are obsolete and victim. But people tended to, they were forced to rely on what was last recognized by the chemical body, which was the right hemisphere. So McLuhan called it the age of intuition, right? But the intuition succumbed to whatever over the last 15 or so years.
So listen to this, Bob. Listen to this. This is a letter that McLuhan wrote to one of the acolytes of Ezra Pound, in 1949.
Wow. Where'd you get this letter?
A guy by the name of Simpson. I don't know if you've heard of him. He was an art dealer in Houston, and he became a big Poundian.
Wow. Where'd you get the letter?
It's in the University of Texas collection.
Wow.
University of Texas has quite a big pound collection, including some letters of Pound and McLuhan. But
did you correspond with them, or did you go there?
No, corresponded with them.
Okay. So you found this letter.
I'll send you this letter.
Okay.
So anyway, the Houston art dealer, his full name was William Dallam, D-A-L-A-M, Simpson, and he was called Bill.
Right.
So this is the very end of a 1949, right? So we're talking over 70 years ago. Remember what you were saying just a minute ago about people willing to go anywhere, right? So he says here, he's talking about the quote-unquote, the absolute squalor and anemia of mind, which is now universal.
Wow. I've been called that in other letters, similar idea, but go ahead.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. So then he says, anybody will agree with that. Everybody, nearly, will retort, so what? Who cares? This is the current cliche on every campus.
That's pretty good, isn't it? Wow.
In the context of what we were saying a minute ago,
yeah.
Quite amazing.
Yes. So what? So he, what is the, can you read more? What's the reason, the paragraph that has that in it? What is he telling the guy?
Well, he's talking about what he calls the inhuman mechanism, which our appetites have created.
Yeah.
So you can tell that this is before the mechanical bride.
Yeah.
Because he's still very caught up in the idea that the problem with modern society is our sinfulness and our appetites. And what we have to do is go through a conversion experience like he had done.
Yeah.
So he's gonna drop that idea. He's gonna go through what I call his second conversion.
Yeah.
Where he realizes that his ideas were Gutenbergian Catholicism, and what he needed was an electric Catholicism, if that were possible.
Mm.
And he decided that it was possible. So he's talking about this inhuman mechanism of modern culture, and then he talks about the absolute squalor and anemia of mind.
Amazing. That's a good thing to know, that one.
Yeah. So earlier in the letter, he's got an interesting quotation. He says, I continue to evolve a Baedeker, a guide to culture adapted to current university student frustration. But this has to go on in the back of my mind till the book I'm doing is done. So the book I'm doing was Mechanical Bride.
Yeah.
And I wasn't aware before that I knew that he was writing the Baedeker in the 1940s. But I didn't realize that he had the idea that it would be a follow-on to Mechanical Bride. So that's an interesting tidbit from this letter as well.
Yeah, read the first line of what you read there. I didn't get it.
I continue to evolve a Baedeker, a Baedeker guide to travel, right?
Yeah, which he did in the 70s, guy doing the early 70s.
Maybe. He always had this idea.
Yeah.
Right? His idea was that he was writing a Baedeker of modern culture.
Yeah.
If you're traveling through modern culture, he wanted to be the travel guide.
Yeah. Our Virgil. Yeah. He wanted to be the Virgil.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the Virgil or the Baedeker or whatever, right?
Coach,
yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Rowing? The coxswain, the cox.
Yeah.
The coxswain. Forget what they used to call it.
Although he was too tall to be that. And
yeah.
He was, so he was a rower.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he calls it a guide to culch, to a guide with culch spelled K-U-L-C-H. And that's Pound's culture, right? Guide
yes.
to culture.
Yes.
So he says, I continue to evolve a Baedeker, a guide to culch adapted to current university student frustration. But this has to go in the back of my mind till a book I'm doing is done.
Right. He had met Pound the year before in 48.
Correct.
And he's in the throes of Poundian enlightenment.
Yes.
And so he's
That's
saying
correct.
Culch. He's doing
Absolutely.
Culch. Yeah.
Yeah. So Pound's insistence on precise reading and precise observation and precise use of words was getting to McLuhan because McLuhan had not paid enough attention to precision in his perception and in his writing up till then.
Yeah.
So Pound kind of took a knife to McLuhan, which he needed.
Yeah, people talk about, or McLuhan scholars talk about the important 49 to 52 Innes influence, but parallel to that is Pound, and that's an intense Pound relationship at the same time.
That's correct, but it's also when he was looking at cybernetics.
Yeah.
Wiener. Then it was also the time that he was thinking in terms of Mallarmé. So there was a lot going on at that point. And then, of course, he was writing The Mechanical Bride. So all of these things were, it was sort of a thundercloud of ideas going on in his mind. And really what he was doing was loading up for the analysis that he would do in the 50s.
Yeah.
Right? He took on a load of stuff, including all of the English poetry that he was dealing with and novels. And then in the 1950s, he had to sort out all that stuff.
Yeah, so, and you also was doing Finney's Wake with Don Thiel. So he was doing all the men of 1914. He wrote a letter to Kenner around 49 saying, I think I'm going to start talking about Lewis a little more. So he was doing all of them. So what caused the explosion of inspiration, say, from 47 to 51? What do you think? Why was it all coming together? Because they were coming out of the doldrums of World War II. The atomic bomb was there. You know, he writes The Southern Quality, which is has a great opening couple of pages. What do you think that I don't know about, or you might know about, that was getting to him in that period?
Well, the most important thing was the transfer of the University of Toronto.
Yeah.
He'd never been in a atmosphere like that, where there were great minds coming at things from many different perspectives.
Yeah.
He had been in a Catholic environment since his conversion in 1937, and then going to Assumption in 44, and then finally coming to Toronto in 46. So for 10 years, he had been in a largely Catholic environment that had reinforced the ideas that led to his conversion. And then at the University of Toronto, with Havelock and with Innes and with a large English department with people, many of whom didn't like McLuhan or his ideas, he was in a challenging environment that forced him to rethink a lot of stuff.
Right.
And another very important thing, in 1944, Siegfried Gideon had written to McLuhan and said, you need to start doing French poetry. And so in the late 1940s, he was working with, especially there was one woman, I forget her name now, but there was a woman who was an expert in French poetry, and he was working with her to go through, especially Mallarmé, but also Baudelaire and Rimbaud. He was working through them in French, and that kind of intense involvement in very complex art was sort of the context in which all of the ideas that we were previously talking about got put into a kind of cement mixer.
Yeah, Don Thiel in The Medium is Rearview Mirror in 71 or so, he writes a note at the end of the book about the importance of the University of Toronto milieu on McLuhan.
So yeah, definitely
Thiel,
true.
Yeah, Thiel pointed that out. What is it? So Toronto, he's in a big city compared to where he was. It's not so cloistered. And he was sailing, right? He did a lot of sailing.
Like Havelock, by the way.
Beg your pardon?
Like Eric Havelock also.
Oh, was he a sailor? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right. I wonder, and then he met Carpenter. Carpenter was a big inspiration or something for him.
Absolutely, absolutely. Carpenter was a lively mind who was not a Catholic. And
he came in from the, he was a spy who came in from the cold.
Yeah, you could say. Yeah. And notice how the cold works with the Arctic.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. Yes, and anthropologists are spies.
I mean, coming into the cold has many meanings.
Yeah, yeah.
So I wasn't sure if you were talking about them all or one.
All of them. But
yeah, well, I agree, of course.
And I'm saying an anthropologist is a spy. And apparently the rumors are the Aboriginals would spy back. They'd play games on each other.
Yeah. Sure, sure.
Okay, so we're talking about that because you wanted to read that letter. Yeah, so what letter? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, all right, so I'm looking at Trump. We're coming out of the Android meme phase, which is like the Matrix, as the movie presents it. It's a bed. The comforting bed, the Android meme. And it's going to go, you know, evolve into some anthropomorphic kind of thing that is, I would call, psychopathic. Now, you notice one of the letters I sent you.
Isn't it already anthropomorphic?
Yes, but it's the Android meme is trying to reflect humans back to them, to hide the fact that it's not human. So it's trying to be as human. So it's scanning the range of human expression, and I like to cite in the 90s the Jerry Springer shows, the so-called dumbing down of American culture. No, that was the Android meme taking out the aggressive, frivolous, rambunctious parts of humans and throwing it back at us. And we got so intrigued by that, we didn't notice it was a simulation.
Uh-huh.
But
notice, you just said something very important. You said something like the Android meme extends over the full range or something like that.
Yeah, human expression.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So what's interesting about that is that the if the full range of human expression is ground, even the Android meme, in attempting to obviate ground, cannot help but rest on ground.
Yeah.
Cannot help but express it.
Yeah, and I mean by the full range of expression, the politeness of media in the analog phase, Like for the famous one in the 50s, they never showed a married couple in bed or something, right? The same bed. There was a decency in culture and a politeness. That's gone.
At least they attempted that.
Yeah, and there always was the underbellies happening. But the underbelly merged with the overbelly in the 90s. And so the obscenity in all levels, Baudrillard talked a lot about this, the obscene. And Barry called it the ob, Barry Nevitt, the obscene, O-B hyphen, S-C-E-N-E.
Yeah.
But the censorship broke down, and nobody could control the means people would culturally make money. every crazy way of expressing yourself and getting an audience became viable commercially. So that's what I mean by the full range of human expression in the Android meme.
Right, but what I'm saying is that, and you're absolutely right in what you're saying. In fact, Harold Innes analyzes the 19th century press revolution in England in exactly those terms.
Mm.
So that's another thing that happened to McLuhan in the period we're talking about, is that he arrives in 1946. His one of his best friends, Tom Easterbrook, arrives in 1947, and Easterbrook is one of the best friends of Innes. So Innes brings McLuhan together with Innes, and McLuhan finds out that one of the things that Innes is always writing about is writing and literature in the 19th century, which was exactly what McLuhan wrote his master's thesis on.
Yeah.
So then McLuhan wants to know if Innes knows anything about what he's talking about, and so he reads the essays of Innes on literature in the 19th century, and he gets blown away because he realizes that there's stuff that Innes is thinking about that he didn't know as an expert in that field.
Yeah.
So this, what you're talking about is the tendency of all media to increase the size of a audience that it's addressing, and thereby to tend to the obscene, is sort of a universal law. It's happened with all media at all times.
Right, and the full range of expression. What would you? How do you think McLuhan, if he was alive in the 90s, what kind of language would he use? How do you think he could talk about it? You know, with Baudrillard and everybody else, Derrida, and all the different forms of criticism that were popping up everywhere. Let's say McLuhan doesn't age. He's vibrant. He's alive. He's watching. What do you think he would say? Would he start to emphasize Finnegan's Wake more?
I don't know. I think I don't see him as changing his old mask as a comedian.
Yeah.
I think he would say that it's impossible to talk to people straight up. So you have to wear a mask, and the best mask is a mask that makes fun of itself.
Yeah.
So sort of a Seinfeld mask.
Yeah. I was also going to say the figure of becoming ground is expressed in how he and Barry used the formula E equals MC squared. Wouldn't that be it? The formula for figure and ground, or the flipping and both content being figure and ground. What do you think of that? E equals MC squared. The item, the E, gets infinite mass at the speed of light, but then he'd have to make it speed of thought, maybe. Now, that would be happening to all kinds of figures as more and more shows are happening with the cable phenomenon. And then the beginning of the computer world. So E equals MC squared. What do you think? Maybe he added to it. Never got stated, but did he obsolesce that, E equals MC squared?
Well, I mean, obsolescence is only one of the four powers in the tetrad, right? So one would have to understand obsolescence as, you know, not an exclusive power.
Right.
But what I don't really know the answer. I don't really know if there is an answer to what you're talking about. But what I like about how you think is that this E equals MC squared, I really hadn't given it much thought. I need to give it some thought. But what you were just saying is interesting. It's fertile.
Right, and Barry does have E equals MC squared somewhere in Take Today.
Oh, definitely. I think in more than one place.
Yes. So what page is the tetrad on Trump? 174?
74.
Oh, 75. 74. At the top of 175 I have. So I was just starting to say that the Enver meme, what pops out of it, is the tech body pops out of the Android meme. Maybe you could say creates a new ground, creates a new space, turns the Android meme into an art form. So I have that in my tetrad, that Trump enhances the Rumpelstiltskin effect over the Android meme. And remember, Rumpelstiltskin, he got away with his rape and pillage if nobody knew his name.
Right.
And so I was asking if McLuhan would have names for what was happening in the 90s, I guess is what I was meaning. Would he be able to continue to call Rumpelstiltskin out for what it is? And that's what you see in my chart. I have down in the corner Rumpelstiltskin as the ground of the chart. And in a sense, the chart is a Rumpelstiltskin. Yeah, well, it's a naming of Rumpelstiltskin, but probably the act of naming becomes a Rumpelstiltskin in itself.
That's why I was just going to say, we can't take Rumpelstiltskin as a simple thing here.
Yeah.
Right? Rumpelstiltskin is a mask of a mask, you could say.
Yeah.
When you say Trump enhances the Rumpelstiltskin effect over the Android meme, one of the things I like about that is you're saying that the Android meme, exactly because it's the Android meme, cannot be one thing.
Yeah.
It must be subject to a dynamic. And one of the dynamics is the Rumpelstiltskin effect, which is in one way, very negative.
Yeah.
Right? It's kind of the, I think, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think one of the main meanings of the Rumpelstiltskin effect is that it's an evil mask. It's the emergence of the human attraction to evil that emerges out of the range of possible human masks.
Right, that's Baudrillard's book or essay. He had the phrase, the demon of images.
Uh-huh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was picking up on that. Yeah, the demon, and I have that in my, is it in that chart? Yeah, I have demon nuclei in the Dobbs quadrant, which was a transient term used in physics in the 80s for a little while. You know, you never hear about it again, but it was listed in John Brockman's book. Now, Brockman was a student of McLuhan. You know, and he became very influential. He created the Third Science series. You know, all these, you know, hip physicists and scientists, he'd make them public figures, you know, move them towards having a TV show or something.
Yeah.
He called it the Third Science. He laid out the five physical particle phases in the 80s in one of his books, and that's where I got the demon nuclei from.
I see. That's interesting. Did he, this, I really haven't heard of Brockman before. Did he stay in Canada, or did he come down to the States?
He was a New Yorker, I think, and he met Gerd Stern, and Gerd turned him on to, the new art movements. He was more of a business guy, you know, not too exciting a person, and but Gerd and other guys got hired for the Monkees movie called Head in 1968. Zappa's in the movie. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
No.
So they made a poster, and so they had to put someone's head on the poster, and Gerd told me they picked, as a joke on Brockman, who was just starting to feel the counterculture, they put his head on the poster. Now, the next year, in 69, he put out a book called By the Late John Brockman, where he went up to Cape Cod or someplace with Bucky Fuller and McLuhan books, all the, quote, heavy books of that period, and sort of crammed his head with them for a few days on the weekend and made notes, and that became the book, By the Late John Brockman. And then he, a year or so later, he did a second book, number 37. It was just 37, but that's how old he was when he did that. But then he, because his wife was the daughter of a heavy literary agent, a major guy in New York, he was able to, get in there through his father-in-law, and he started being an agent for William Irwin Thompson and early people in the 70s. So he got in early for the baby boomer thinkers and became a major literary agent. And he started, if you want to look it up, edge.org, a website that's been around for a long time, which interviews all the latest in science or scientists and academics. So, he's far from being a Canadian. But in I first heard about him, I saw a review of By the Late John Brockman when I was in Seattle in 69 in the East Village Other, so I was aware of him in that sense, that he did a book saying he was dead, and didn't keep up with him. But then one day in around 1977 in the coach house, Mark says, "You got to take a look at this book." So she hands it to me, and it was 100 Philosophers, some kind of title like that. And it went through 100 philosophers from cultures all over the world, and you'd read the biography of one page, and then you had to figure out something. I forget what it was. It was a little game. You had to choose something. So there'd be these facts or anecdotes about the person, and then you had to figure out who it was. Well, what struck me was number 100, the last philosopher, was Marshall McLuhan. And I said, that's correct. McLuhan's the last philosopher. At least that's what I felt in 1977. So I bought the book and thought it was pretty cool. And he co-wrote it with a guy named Edwin Schlossberg, who ended up marrying Carolyn Kennedy, JFK's daughter.
Yeah.
So they were a prominent couple, and I think Schlossberg went on to do some kind of interesting architecture in New York City. What else to say? So when I went to New York in 93, when we moved there, I wanted to meet John Brockman. So I called him up and talked about my interest in McLuhan, and I knew what he'd done and all that. And he said, well, I didn't know how successful he was at that point and how, quote, busy, because he said, well, I'm really busy. He was just really, he booms through the 90s. He's a big deal in the 90s. He says, but I can get you in touch with Gerd Stern. He's the guy you want to talk to about McLuhan. And so that's how I met Gerd, which turned out to be really important. You know, Gerd is on page 198 of From Cliché to Archetype. He's mentioned. They did the mixed media art. Were you going to say something in the middle there?
I was just going to say that I guess when you said that Brockman was a student of McLuhan, I had taken you to mean that he was a student at University of Toronto.
But no.
You must mean that he was just somebody who read his books.
And he always talked about McLuhan. It was a big influence. Even now I saw some interview, and he said when he discovered McLuhan, that exploded his mind. Of course, it's from my point of view, he's a trivial McLuhanite. You know what I mean? No clue, but something sparked him that he thinks it was via McLuhan. Which I guess that's the job of someone like a public artist or thinker is to do that. They don't necessarily have to, the audience doesn't have to get what you're saying, but you somehow intrigue them and get them thinking in a strange way or a new way, and then you might do new things in your life. Dave Wally, who did the first rock biography.
By the way, I don't believe that at all, but I just put that in parentheses as you thought there.
Yes. Dave Wally, who did the first rock biography in the early 70s on Zappa, he spent all his life in New York City, and he knew a lot of people. And he said, Bob, you'd be amazed at how many people made millions using McLuhan. Maybe the people didn't. I don't know if he said this, but he could have might have said this, that nobody knew they were using McLuhan or how they were inspired, but he kind of noticed a lot of people. Somehow McLuhan inspired people to come up with stuff to get attention and then make something happen for themselves. As a matter of fact, when J.W., who became a friend of Warren Buffett, Warren in 2009, J.W. called me up. This was before Ion. And he says, what's tactility, Bob? And I had actually brought it up a few times. And so I started to express it and define it. But I said, why do you want to know now? He said, well, I just had dinner with Warren Buffett, and he was telling me how much he was influenced by Marshall McLuhan in the 60s. And he was talking about tactility. I didn't know what he was talking about. So there you have it right there, Warren Buffett, right? Something in McLuhan gave him ideas that put him in some confidence or whatever he did. Figured out how to be an investor, whatever he does. You see? See, this is where McLuhan is part of the, the lingua franca, the ground of his time.
It's not wrong to say part of the ground of his time, as long as you use ground there in the sense of one ground amongst many.
Yeah.
What you're talking about is an influence of McLuhan in exactly the way that he did not want to be an influence.
Yes.
His whole intention was to be influential in the exact opposite direction.
And what is that? Is that he's not a cognitive artist? He's an elitist artist?
No, not at all. But what you're talking about is people who are the motor of modern civilization, if you want to call it civilization. People making money, making moves, all this sort of stuff, and basically they're driving a car towards the abyss. It's ridiculous, right? So McLuhan would try to alert them to what they were doing and would have them either stop the car or turn it around.
What would you call what he was doing? He's just a warning?
A strategy for survival is what he called it over and over again.
Right. Okay. So.
And these people were anti-survivalists.
Yeah. Another guy influenced by McLuhan is it Norman Lear? Who's the guy who did Archie Bunker in those TV shows?
Yeah, Norman Lear.
Yeah, he's Mary McLuhan told me that Terry was a good friend of theirs and would spend every summer at some point with the Lears. So Jack Nicholson, I read an article by him in 1971 in some magazine, and he was talking about the idea of the cliche. It sort of completed his understanding of acting, and he got that from McLuhan, he said. So who knows the users of content? Who knows what people gets? But McLuhan is, I think Duchamp said, 30 years after an artwork is made, it becomes public property. So maybe that's the where McLuhan becomes part of the language and part of the ground. That is him becoming public property, and it's out of his hands what his ambitions are.
Well, that's right, but that's all part of the cul-de-sac. What you're talking about is what might be called the quicksand of history. And all of these things that you're talking about are aspects of the quicksand pit that is pulling McLuhan and all of us down into oblivion. And he's trying to figure out a way out of the pit. And so part of the difficulty is that his attempts to figure a way out of the pit are continually mis-taken.
Yeah.
And that's what can I say? It's the
inevitable.
It's inevitable. It's the dynamic of the opposition, you could say.
Right. Do you see anybody, or you see a lot of people attempting to do what he did, or tried to do it?
Yeah, I see a lot of people. Sure. And I think, for example, when he had this lifelong book that he was writing called Great Tom on Eliot, I think he realized that Eliot was trying to do the same thing as he was, or he was trying to do the same thing as Eliot, better said. He probably realized that part of Pound, not all of Pound, I think lots of Pound sort of scared McLuhan, but parts of Pound were trying to do the same thing. Parts of Lewis, Bucky Fuller, lots of people were attempting to do what he was attempting, and I think he probably had great respect for them.
Right. Would he think John Lennon was trying to do something?
Yeah, probably, but that's like your conversations with Jack.
Oh, Jack. Give me my Instagram things?
No, isn't your conversations with the basketball player, isn't his name?
Yeah, yeah. That's on Instagram. Yeah, the young guy.
I just see references to it every once in a while on your website.
Right.
I didn't know it was on Instagram.
Yeah, you haven't looked at one.
No.
Yeah,
no, I'm not interested in stuff like that, Bob.
You ought to take a look. Maybe I do a new version. So I read this somewhere. McLuhan writing to Wilfred Watson in 1964. I think you know this letter. He says, talk about blind spots and regions of maximal impact. Looking at the diabolical principle just now, I read loud and clear that art must be totally environmental. It must be the content of nothing whatever. Ergo, the vortex equals the totally environmental. Didn't you read me this letter to me?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, a few discussions ago.
Right. It might be timely again. Wyndham Lewis wants nothing less for art than the power to create total environments for life and death. There must be no art as content of some other set of skills or interests. I find it a bit staggering to confront Lewis as a man who really wanted to be Pontifex Maximus of a magical priesthood. I suppose Yeats, Joyce, and Pound had similar aspirations. Their priesthood was to create new worlds of perception. Is that what we're saying?
Yes. And that's exactly what we're saying. Because what McLuhan is regretting in those people is the lack of perception of a plurality of grounds. I think he's probably wrong as regards Joyce and Eliot and Pound, by the way, and Lewis too. It's an oversimplification.
You're saying that he criticized them for failing to see multi-ground?
Yes, in that letter. In that letter.
Yeah.
I don't think he did that all the time. But the point, I think, is very well taken, and it's the point I'm making about the culture gurus that you're talking about in New York.
Yeah.
That what these people do is that they harness a ground and then ride it into wealth. But what McLuhan was interested in was the plurality of grounds and trying to communicate that to a civilization that was potentially killing itself by, you know, riding these horses into great wealth.
Right. So the plurality of grounds is what I mean by quadrophenia.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Very good. That Trump is quadrophenic. So that might help us to get to what I mean.
But is
by
he
Trump.
Is he consciously? Everybody's quadrophenic.
Yes.
It's just a question of do they know it or not. So does Trump realize that? I don't think so.
He's realized something. he hijacked the process.
But wait a minute. The word realize, excuse me, has very different meanings.
Yeah.
Right? You can realize some fashion, meaning you can instantiate it. You can be an exemplar of it, right? But realize can also mean understanding it. And those are two very different things.
Yeah.
So to me, Trump does realize certain things, but he doesn't realize those things in terms of understanding. Now, maybe you have a different view. I don't know. But
well, I have different access to him. And remember, he listens to me a lot. So he's listening to the right guy. I mean, I don't think anybody else is listening to me, but he is. But that's because of Ion.
Well, Bob, when we talk, I listen to you. I try to understand the depths from which you're coming.
No, I guess I meant public figures, you know, famous people, the
not
idiots.
Not somebody inconsequential.
Yeah, not somebody who's a nobody from Regina who's an up-and-coming McLuhanite. No, not that.
Yeah.
But I'm talking to you. They may be listening to me, but I'm talking to you, so there's the compliment.
All right, well, but I didn't regard what you said about being a nobody from Regina. I didn't regard that as anything but a compliment.
I know. Best to be a nobody.
The way to be a somebody in the present environment is to be a nobody.
Yeah.
Everybody's running around being a somebody, and that's the problem.
Those are role players.
Yeah, inevitably. Yeah,
yeah,
they're realizing in the sense of being exemplars, right? Whereas what I'm trying to do is realize in the sense of not being an exemplar.
Yeah.
But that's what a nobody is.
Yeah. Well, like I said, that's why I'm talking to you.
Yeah, well, good.
I'm not making any effort to have a series with Mr. Trump, you know? I'm not trying to talk to him.
There you go.
I don't desire to talk to him. Might have to someday.
But do you think that Trump was somebody who realized, in the sense of understanding, realized these things, or do you think he just realized them in the sense of being an exemplar,
totem? He realized what he needed to do to become president. I mean, he was very familiar with the pop media junk world of New York. He knew how to hijack the media. He knew how to become president, but that's not necessarily an important position. You know?
Right. And it's a realization in the exemplar sense.
Becoming president is the exemplar sense.
And so it's you're realizing a fashion. You're realizing a certain mask. You're realizing a certain role.
Yeah, you're creating a role, and you are acknowledged. You become a somebody.
Yes.
A big mistake.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
You become a totem.
Yes. So, Trump obsolesces the continuous iconic TV image, and probably continuous means their visual space. The continuity from one administration to the next, right? Continuity of government, I think they call it. That's a fact that isn't true, but we project a visual uniformity or linearity onto the thing. So the continuous
so that's
icon.
That's closely related to the enhancing effect.
Yeah.
Because in order to have the Rumpelstiltskin effect over the Android meme, you have to have discontinuity.
Yeah.
And so the first one is discontinuity, and that's what's enhanced. And then the obsolescent is the continuity.
Yeah. And that's what everybody got upset about, that Trump didn't appear to be fulfilling the continuous iconic role.
That's right. That's right. It was something new in the history of the country.
Yeah. And the New York, I saw a little documentary years ago on the New York Times journalists, Maggie somebody, Halberstam or whatever, they say it was hell every day trying to figure out what to write about the guy because he did so many different things all day long. You know, they couldn't get they couldn't get continuity.
Yeah.
So they just started bashing him, I guess.
Right. But notice that continuity, again, has two faces. Or discontinuity, better to talk about that. Discontinuity has two faces. You can be discontinuous in life and be screwed up because of the discontinuity.
Yeah.
Or you can realize the discontinuity of ground, and then that's a completely different thing.
Yeah, I agree. I wonder, I think I used to say there was always an eye and ear modality of everything.
Yes. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The ratio between eye and ear is what McLuhan calls media.
Calls media?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you always
and
have
by the
to...
way, and I think it's on page 14 or page 13 of Finnegan's Wake. Let me just find the exact quotation here.
In the ignorance that knits, if it's in the ignorance that
no.
knits the impression, that's page 18.
No. It's 'tis optophone which ontophanes.
Right.
And so optophone is eye ear.
Right. Yes.
Right. So, onto is reality and phanes is shining forth. So what Joyce says there is that it is the ratio of eye-ear which shines forth our realities, which is exactly what we were talking about.
Yeah, so the shining forth, would that be tactility? The clear white light of tactility?
Well, no, in order to shine forth, you have to have an origin and an end, and tactility is between the origin
yeah.
and the end.
Right.
So shining is itself tactility, you could say.
Yeah, shining itself is tactility.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Yes, he talks about that sentence in one of the 50s explorations essays, doesn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's what I'm
looking at.
That's what I'm referring to. Yeah, it's the 1954, New Media's Political Forms
yeah.
and Explorations 3.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you have...
But funny, it's strange that he doesn't continue that.
Yeah.
He doesn't deal further with optophone, although you could say that the optophone principle, as he calls it, is what his whole life was about.
Yeah. What does he say around it? In that paragraph, that's part
yeah,
of...
Yeah, you want me to read that paragraph
yeah,
too?
Yeah,
okay, he says, for the lineal procedure of individual awareness, Joyce, in his last work, substituted an everyday roundabout with intrusions from above and below. That's more or less a quotation. What the hell was the guy's name? I can't remember at the moment, but a guy that wrote about Joyce in 1930 or 32 had that to say. For those locked in the metallic and rectilinear embrace of the printed page, Joyce appears as a surrealist magician or clown. but his optophone principle in art provides the key for future literary and social education. The optophone is an instrument for turning images into sounds. Surrounded by a vast new imagery, technological man has yet to learn how to interpret this imagery verbally or socially. Until he learns its language, it will continue to act on him like the new liquid meat tenderizers.
I have
a full post on that.
Okay. Optophone. What I was going to say about that. You're not thinking of Laszlo Moholy Nagy, who wrote on Joyce in the 40s.
No, although he's related to this because he was one of the guys that made a kind of octophone machine.
His neighbor, the guy who lived at 7 Eccles Street. Forget his name. He's Cranley in The Portrait of the Artist. He's a guy that, he did cryptography. That guy?
No. Are you talking about the guy that wrote on Finnegan's Wake?
No.
Talking about somebody who built an octophone or something?
Yeah, no, he built a key for all cryptography, tried to sell it to the American military. And he lived at 7 Eccles Street, Bloom's address. And he's in Ulysses, and in Portrait of the Artist, he's the colleague of Stephen named Cranley. But his real name, he was a friend of Joyce, a key friend. His Tom Easterbrook, you know. And so Joyce did a version of the guy's cryptograph on page about 137 of Finney's Wake. It's in the first page of War and Peace in the Global Village. McLuhan talks about the two of them. But there's a Stuart somebody who did a biography. I think who wrote about, you don't mean Joseph Campbell, that's the 40s.
Right.
I wonder who you mean. And he invented things.
I'll find out in a second.
In a second, did you say?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll wait. Second's over. How'd it go? And, you know, what you just read was describing the linear, the visual continuity, and then the oral continuity. That paragraph illustrated the continuity here, the continuous, the two forms of continuity.
Well, I don't know I would say that.
Look at the first sentence. It says the linear something was a problem. What is the very first words of that paragraph of optophone?
Yeah, I have to go back. Okay, the lineal procedure of individual awareness. Joyce substituted an everyday roundabout with intrusions from above and below.
Yes, that's
so. Those aren't two kinds of continuity, but one is a type of continuity. The second
is discontinuity.
Well, it's both continuity and discontinuity together.
Yeah.
Just
okay.
As it's above and below.
Yeah. So that's, I guess it's not two kinds of continuity. It's continuity
right.
And then eye and then ear. Discontinuity. So, or tactility. Anyways, it fit into this sequence we're working on here. So then Trump retrieves the knight and the vampire. The knight is for the pro-Trumpers, you know, 50% of the voters. He was the white knight, and the white racist knight. And but for the other half of the population, he was something from the depths of the Nazi hell creatures. He was a vampire. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
that's an excellent line, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and so then he reverses into go ahead.
Just for the knight and the vampire, do you think he was consciously trying to be both?
I think as an artist, as an instinctive public figure, he had a talent for it. So how much does one have to realize it? He knows what to do every day to keep in the game. And he might not be able to step aside and say what he's doing, but he'd say, sir, I can't explain this, and then he'd go and continue doing it.
Yeah.
So,
but notice how we're back to the the ambiguity of realizing. You're absolutely right that he could realize these roles.
Yeah.
But my question is it a realization only in the sense of exemplifying, or is it also some kind of understanding of what's going on with this role flipping?
Yeah, the role of knowing. Well, I think the dialectic McLuhan has an ecclesiastic archetype around about page 160 or something, is knowing and growing. So there's the continuous, that would be your endless crux. What's the word? Forget the word. What, the cusp, what's the bad thing we're talking about? The cul-de-sac. Okay. The cul-de-sac, the universal or the ongoing cul-de-sac that everybody confronted, the greats, that's the, what was I going to say with that? That's the continuity. That's the constant. Ion talks about the platitudes and the vicissitudes. So you see the same issues always being confronted.
Yes.
Remember he says the conditions of the artists are the same, but the conditions are always changing? Do you remember that line back in the 40s? The conditions of art are changing, but the artist's condition is the same, something like that. So go ahead.
Well, that's exactly where I draw the parallel with chemistry. Right? Chemical elements are always the same, but the world that is produced out of those elements is always changing.
Always what?
Changing.
Changing, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so now, what does Trump reverse into? The image of an emperor come saint. His likeness will be lasered into Mount Rushmore. There's no indication of that happening today, but watch what happened. Trump is our only president. He's still the president. Biden can't even find the right set design to fake his White House. He's not in the White House. He has never been in there, and he's not allowed to be in there. So he can't be a president. He can't arrive at it. This is what's interesting. So Trump goes around being the popular, rabble rouser or pop star or icon of kinetic charisma, right? So he's the president. The president was a cheerleader anyways for the last few decades, and he's still doing it. Biden can't do it.
Yeah. But you see, I agree with what you're saying somewhat, but it's not the case that the quote role, unquote, of the quote president, unquote, is the same thing. You were right before when you said that the role of the president has undergone a revolution.
Yeah.
And it's not at all the same thing. So you can't then go from the role of the president being completely different to saying that, well, Trump is the president in the old sense. You might say he's the president in a new sense.
Yeah, I would say that.
Right? Yeah.
And you might even say that he flipped into a Biden image. And Trump was too much for people, so they had to have an incompetent a person who couldn't finish his syllables. That's my joke about Biden. Trump couldn't finish his sentences. Biden can't finish his syllables.
Right. yeah. But what you could say that Biden is not immediately related to Trump, but he is immediately related to the role of the obsolescence of the role of the president.
Yeah.
He's the representation of the old age of a form of government that doesn't work.
Right. Does not work.
Maybe.
That's a major fact. It does not work.
Correct. Correct. It's been taken over.
Yeah.
Right. It's a bureaucratic form that can be run even by people that aren't American. That can be run from elsewhere.
Yeah.
So it's, it's an obsolete form that has the power of blowing up the world if it wants to express its powerlessness.
Yes. So
in that way. By the way, the guy that wrote part about Finnegan's Wake being a roundabout way is Frank Budgen.
I was going to say him. That was his buddy. He was an artist.
There you go.
And he was McLuhan's favorite interpreter of Joyce because he was an artist and he knew what he was doing, whatever Joyce was doing, you know, in a similar ballpark as artists. Yeah, Frank Budgen. So what do you thought he invented something?
No, that was Moholy Nagy.
Okay.
That's related to the optophone, but that's a film that Moholy Nagy did in the 40s.
Right. Okay. So, yeah, Frank Budgen. I was going to say the inadequacy of cultural criticism. So you hear the whoever they are, the strangers that run the universities, are always saying we're encouraging critical awareness. But, you know, you come to college, you become a critic, and if you're not doing that, you're not doing great. The obsolescence of the ability to have critical perception is not achievable in the Gutenberg sense or any whatever they think they are doing critical position. So you'll find that whatever.
Bob, did you say the obsolescence is not achievable?
Yeah, I go that far, right. Be obsolete critic. Wasn't that the line, Cecil B. DeMille? Critics, don't even ignore them.
Yeah, well, that's okay.
Yeah, but my insight here is that people try to figure out what the problem with Trump is, and they might come up with something. But it's always going to be inadequate. It's not enough. So if I say something and people say, no, that's not the whole story, I immediately agree with them. Right. It's pretty hard. You'd have to give me 5 minutes to list off 100 aspects of the whole story. So I'm relaxed about saying one aspect of Trump. I'm not saying that's the whole thing.
I agree.
Yeah.
But humans aren't capable of the whole thing. What all these culture vultures or what all these university administrators want is the whole thing. They want the wrong thing.
Yeah. They really are so obsolete. Which means you're everywhere if you're obsolete, right? You've been duplicated, cloned all over the place because obsolete means more and more use of it.
Right.
So I was thinking that... So. If you understand, yes, as I talk about Trump, I could talk for an hour about one theme, then talk for an hour about a completely different, maybe contradictory theme about Trump, knowing that you have to pile up the different angles on it. that's Finnegan's Wake. The guy was making a daily diary-like inventory of his multimedia grounded experience and registering it, just noting it. And
yep.
So he makes a huge inventory, a Manichaean list, you know, framed around the Ten Thunders, but it's the endless inventory. He continues writing the book after it's published. He keeps working on it, processing his diary. So
just like he did with Ulysses.
Right. So I think we talked about that last time, the process that Joyce discovered as an information artist. He went from being a novelist to an information artist, processing the information environment. And that's what McLuhan figured out that. That was his role.
Let me read something to you here from a book that Joyce read in the middle 20s when he was getting going on Finnegan's Wake. And the book is called Quo Vadimus.
What?
Where are we going?
Where are we going? Quo Vadimus.
Yeah.
Who wrote that?
The guy's name is too hard to say. I'll tell you that in a minute.
Yeah.
But I'll first give you the quote. He says, and it's part of a series of books that address the question of the future, of where are we going? And Joyce read a whole bunch of this series and took out bits and pieces from these people that he would use in Finnegan's Wake.
Mm.
And so lots of these people contemplated, you know, how television would take over the world, and how humans would populate other planets and all of this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And Joyce took it all in. But anyway, this guy says, if Mars, millions of years older than ourselves, has arrived at such a stage of advancement that it can think of transcending its own borders, it may make some attempt at communication. But the attempt might take the form which to us would be quite unrecognizable. But some observers thought that the persistent thunderstorms experienced during the last opposition, and I think by opposition he means alignment between Mars and Earth, during the last opposition over wide areas were signs of such an attempt. Now, look at here. We have the thunder. In Finnegan's Wake, I believe Joyce uses the phrase something like Mars talking.
Mm.
Or Mars attempting to communicate, something like that.
Yeah.
Which I believe refers to this passage here.
Mm.
Now, what's quite amazing about this is that the guy who wrote this book is the guy that invented the optophone. Believe it or not, the optophone was invented in the first machine was 1912, but the improved machine was 1914, and it appeared in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. And the optophone was a real machine that attempted to scan print and turn it into musical tones so that a blind person could take a book or a newspaper, put it in the machine, and then know what the newspaper or book were saying by listening to the music.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
So then Joyce takes the optophone and uses that in Finnegan's Wake along with things from this guy's book, which was written 10 years later. And I believe the guy's name is Fournier, but I'll have to go up and, yeah, it's Fournier d'Alba. So Fournier, his real last name is Fournier, but he was French, and so he had Fournier d'Alba. D'Alba was, you know, the where the family was originally from. But now listen to this, Bob.
But just before you go on, did you say that this book was written 10 years after the start of the wake?
Yes. No, 10 years after the Optophone was announced.
Oh, okay.
And the Proceedings of the Royal Society.
Yeah.
Okay. So, this guy invents this machine, and the Proceedings of the Royal Society publish a picture of it and a description of it in 1914. But this guy himself was not a fellow of the Royal Society, FRS. And so he had to have the proceedings did not publish stuff from outside the Royal Society. They published, you had to be a member of the Royal Society to publish, or you had to have somebody publish a paper for you as what was called a communication. So this guy's announcement of the Optophone in 1914 was a communication from a physicist by the name of Sir Oliver Lodge. And Sir Oliver Lodge...
Was he related to Winnipeg?
Yeah, he was the uncle of Rupert Lodge, who was McLuhan's great mentor in Winnipeg.
Wow. That's pretty good.
It's amazing, right?
Yeah. Another link. Did you just discover that?
Yeah, I wrote a post on it. Yeah.
So what is it against? So Oliver Lodge, what did he do with the Optophone or the Optophone?
Well, first off, he was a physicist, and the guy that invented the Optophone was working in Lodge's lab for some years. And so in the description of the Optophone, he says that he owes a great deal of gratitude to Oliver Lodge for helping him in the process. So Oliver Lodge was a physicist who became the principal of Birmingham University. When he was a professor of physics, he was at the University of Liverpool. And I don't know which of those two was the place where this Fournier guy invented the Optophone.
Right.
But the fact is, the Optophone was a real machine. It appears in Finnegan's Wake. It was a communication from Sir Oliver Lodge. And Sir Oliver Lodge was the uncle of Rupert Lodge, who was McLuhan's mentor in Winnipeg.
There you go. Hey, there's the, that's, I call it the God's view. God's eye view. God's view, because God, it can see who's connected to who that humans can't see.
Yep. Yeah, no, that's a fine description of God.
Yeah, yeah. The, did I ever tell you, I think I mentioned this, my favorite is when McLuhan is heading for Dover the day the war breaks out, you know, he and Corinne are in Paris, and they're running to the border.
Right.
I don't know if they get on a train or whatever, but they head to
go
across.
Yeah, they were on a train.
Yeah. At the same time, where McLuhan would end up on the coast of France to get the boat to go across, very near there, James Joyce was at a clinic for his daughter. And then, the same day, what's floating down the, what's it called, the channel? What's that, the river?
Yeah, the channel.
The channel between England and France. That
yeah,
McLuhan,
the ditch, they call it.
The what?
They call it the ditch.
Oh, yeah, okay. The English Channel. Is that what they call it, the English Channel?
Yeah.
And so Lewis is floating down, McLuhan's passing by, and Joyce is on the shore. The three factors of some kind of significance are all together on that day in the same area. Isn't that neat?
And was Joyce in England or in France?
He was in France, northern France, where the clinic was for his daughter.
Okay.
And Lewis.
And his daughter ended up in a clinic in England.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know that. And
yeah, I think in Nottingham or someplace like that.
Okay. And Lewis, he's on a boat, and he's supposed to be on a previous boat, but he didn't get on it. That one goes out and heads toward Iceland and gets bombed and sinks. So he luckily, he would have died on that one, but he got pushed to the next boat behind him. And so he made it to New York. But you think of the three of them quite, you know, resonant with each other. Or what is it? Proximity of visual space.
Yeah, proximate is the word you're looking for.
Yeah, they're approximate. Is it with an AP or just P?
No.
Proximate.
Just P. Yeah.
Yeah, they were proximate. And they are going to, they're going to express what the war is really about. That
maybe
starts that day. The background and what was to come. So that's one of my favorite God's eye view.
But do you know that Lewis was in the channel? I mean, usually boats across the Atlantic were leaving from Liverpool or some port like on the western side,
right?
Maybe Belfast, even in Ireland.
Well, I remember he got on a boat, and then he got docked, maybe in France, and they had to get on another boat. And there was an odd interruption. So maybe the boat came, went out of Liverpool, went down to France, and then he got onto the safe boat by accident. And then it was a day late. But I'd have to find a biography or something, which I might have out there in the library. It goes into those details of Lewis's life.
Oh, you'd be able to find that on Google, I think, pretty easily.
Oh, okay. All right, so Trump reverses into the image of an emperor come saint. This may be wrong, but I wonder what I'm getting at.
I'm not sure. That, to me, that seems like the weakest
of
the four.
Right now, it seems that
weak. Yeah, exactly. It may be something that I just don't understand yet.
Yeah. For the pro-Trumpers, they now consider him a saint.
A saint.
Because Biden is so bad, they would think. And they hanker to get Trump back. Don't think he can come back. But a lot of other things are falling apart, so we have predicted that he'll become viceroy of the new government, the new post, what do you call it, executive, legislative, and judiciary. The three-part structure of government will collapse, and a new feudalism comes in, and he'll be the viceroy of it.
Uh-huh.
Did I hear you laughing a minute ago when I said viceroy?
No, the three parts of government have already collapsed.
Yes, yeah.
Right? The courts don't work. Congress doesn't work. And the president doesn't work.
That's right. And I saw a poll a couple of days ago, you know, 50% of Americans say, get rid of the Supreme Court. You know, there's this obsolescence when the populace feels this way about it.
Right.
That's the effect.
But how dangerous would that be, right?
Well, you mean if they got rid of the court?
Yeah.
Well, we're in incredibly dangerous situation. We talk about it all the time. But and I guess we're in the middle of the danger is killing people. People are dying for all kinds of crazy reasons. People who didn't expect to die. You know, they thought they had a few more years on them.
Right.
So we're in a kind of apocalypse or Armageddon or business as usual.
Yeah.
Okay, so we did a tetrad on Trump, and those, you got the Android meme, the iconic TV image, then historical phenomenon, Knight and Emperor and vampire, and then emperor. I'm sort of looking at it as the tech body is a scattershot. It's just shooting out all over the place and making sure that what's prominent today is not prominent tomorrow. Might get retrieved later in the week, but the replacement of the focus of attention that the Trump body the tech body wants is the ground or the way it looks. What would you call that? Is that the figure? The way it looks? The way obvious sense perception sees it? Because they would put it into familiar terms. So what do you call that?
Well, that's phenomenalizing. It's concretion.
Yeah.
You might say that can be an effect of the tech body, but you can't say that that's the tech body itself.
Right.
Surely not.
Yep.
And I noticed that you say Trump enhances the Rumpelstiltskin effect over the Android meme. So that's the kind of a flip of one mask.
Yes.
And then you seem to be saying that the tech body is the ground of the flipping of the Android meme.
Yeah.
Would that be a correct reading?
Yep.
Yeah? Okay.
Because it pops out, but it was underneath. It was a hidden a coming environment. And so, yeah, what's the phrase you just said? It not pops out, but you said it's the ground.
Nominalizers? Or?
No, the ground. It's the invisible ground. And then it became visible. Or maybe not visible. The effects of it are disrupting people.
Right.
Is that the figure? The effects, they are a figure, right?
Yeah, so if we can say that the tech body is the realization of the potential of flipping within the Android meme.
Yeah.
Then the realization of that in the sense of the exemplarization of that at the phenomenal level is a flipping, right? People are flipping out, as the expression goes, but they're flipping out because they don't realize the ground of flipping.
Now, all that you just said, that describes the Trump phenomenon as it was presented by the tech body. You see?
Okay.
See, Trump represents this complex situation you were just...
Right. So that's why I was asking earlier about the relationship of realization to realization.
Right, right.
So now you seem to be saying that Trump presents...
Well, I would say he flipping. Realizes. He realizes.
Okay.
Yeah.
He realizes this flipping.
Yeah.
Does he realize in the sense of understanding or realizes in the sense of exemplifies?
Well, I was going to say, it immediately came to me that the one who understands is the observer. So that's the Gutenberg phase of understanding. What is the electronic Marconi phase of understanding? Is it remaining anonymous? Is it a kind of poise one has that people who you bump into notice? What is the...
I think all of those are correct.
Yeah. Yeah, that's quite
a meaning. Poise refers to the fulcrum.
Yeah.
A poise is something that is in between.
Yeah.
And poise is a very good way of saying that.
I think somebody, it might have been McLuhan, he made a pun on porpoise. Poor poise. Poor poise. Porpoise.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, the cosmic skin diver of the TV age, what are we today? There was one ocean. In the global theater of the 60s. What do we have now? Well, it's a common metaphor. You hear people talk about parallel worlds. They talk about that a lot. more than they did 10 years ago. Timelines, people seem to have an acceptance of multiple environments.
Yeah.
And that would be what animal lives in multiple environments? Oh, a demon. A demon. And we're all demons. And McLuhan said that. You can be an angel or a devil. You remember that quote? Not sure where it was.
A vague recollection of that, yeah. I think he talked about that stuff in more than one place.
Yeah, the role player can be an angel or a devil.
Mm-hmm. And human beings are continually flipping between those.
Yeah. Which then comes to his point that you can't have morality or ethics in these conditions.
Right.
So what we're saying here, we just said, is what nobody covers. They might in some academic course go into Nietzsche, Beyond Good and Evil or something, but they'll find it in a book. They don't see it in the environment. That's the perceptions required to see it, to see this quadraphenic flipping and amoral existence in today. So then all through today, and what people make money from, wealth is generated by outrage and judgment and retrieving morality or finger pointing, right? That is what Coker calls abuse value. That is what makes wealth. What can't be completed, realized, exploited, or get benefits from. See, you can't go with the traditional human chemical body balancing mechanisms. You need a new kind of balance. So you have to recognize your multiple environments. That's first. Because then you'd have to have a new kind of balance. Not
yeah, I agree with that. But if that's first, what's second?
What would you say? That's first?
If you said first, you have to recognize multiple environments,
right,
which require a new kind of balance.
Yeah.
But if that's first, what's second?
Well, I was saying the obsolescence of the cosmic skin diver, and then you become a demon.
So
that may be enough.
I'd
say there's no second. You recognize the multiple environments. That's all you need to do. You couldn't do anything about it. You have to ride them. Then you have to realize you are these environments, and you're going to be demonized. And that's what they say is happening in America. Maybe the West, I don't know, but America, the breakdown of social decency, social communication, social respect, and blatant murder going on in the streets all day long.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty drastic, right?
Yeah.
And McLuhan said in Playboy, 1968, end of the year, mind your media, men, or you'll catch a cold environment. Okay, so I took that tack that I couldn't come up with a two. Now, let's say another tack would be to come up with the second. So what would that be? You recognize the multiple environments, and then you buy my products for for sane nutrition, because you're not going to get anywhere else. It's partly serious. That's what I do recommend. Okay. I was thinking about bringing this up today. Do media change matter? All right. Now, the thesis we have is that matter is radically changing, and your body processes are out of line with it, out of sync. So you got to take our products to get synced in, get new matter in your body to be potentially almost harmonious with what's happening in matter. So, do media change matter? They change our images of matter. And is matter only an image? We actually don't have matter. And that is altered by media. So, I say we got a profound changing of our images of matter. and this is very disorienting. And doctors' tools don't work anymore. Their scales of measurement of how you're doing don't work. And our product is the balance to that. I mean, that's, in terms of living media causality, that's what I live. That's what I say. I got proof of it every day that it works. You know, that's my mediacology, paramediacology.
Mm-hmm. But somewhere in the last 15 minutes or so, I kind of, I wasn't sure if we were on page 175 of your book and doing exegesis there, or if you had kind of jumped out of the book and were on to something else. I mean, you ended up with your products, and obviously that isn't right here. But I lost the connection somehow.
Well, that's
good. I
wasn't
sure where you took off from.
Right, but that's what I'm acting out what we do. That's quadriphenia. We hop into areas that surprise others. In what you do in business, or social life, your private recreation, that's everybody is, what did McLuhan said? Everybody's forced to be an explorer or an artist today.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what people are doing, we would say, without understanding. They don't know. You could say Trump intuits it, but the majority of people aren't in any focused on position, which will make them have to come up with defining what they're doing. They're adrift, and that's what McLuhan ended an essay. Well, we continue to drift. So with so many drifting, they don't have the anchor of understanding. And that's what's dangerous, right? The majority of people are like that.
That's the whole civilization.
Yeah,
is drifting in a way that the word civilization doesn't apply anymore.
Right.
So that's what the cul-de-sac is.
Right. Now, do we, are there any columnists? See, we're writing a column here, speaking, uttering, making a column.
Let's say, sure.
Beg your pardon?
Let's say.
Yeah, let's say we're doing that. And you will not get a properly written column like we're making, because people just say, things are bad. If we do this or that, maybe it'll get better. It's always a panic, hysteria, schizophrenia, and paranoia, or over-ecstasy, as I have in my chart. It's always a fragmented expression.
Yeah, a fragmented expression which wants to take itself as non-fragmented.
Right. And there's no place where you could write a column discussing that like that other than your own blog. Would the New York Times let you do an op-ed saying what we're saying? They might, but not likely. They'd say this has to be for grade 8. You know what I mean? They align the style of writing to a certain age group. You know, the New York Post, grade 8, what would be New York Times, freshman college or something?
Yeah, but I mean, doing a column in a newspaper or doing a show on TV, it's not going to do anything. I mean, it's just going to be further drifting.
So I say our series is doing something.
Maybe.
It may be valuable at some point in indefinite span of time. It may be what people would find soothing after all kinds of ruptures.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're doing, in my view at least, we're doing all that can be done, and that is to try to say it like it is.
Yeah. And I think in Newsweek, 1968, McLuhan was interviewed, might have been about the Dew Line, I remember, like July, but he said he was making new commandments. He was doing a Moses. You ever seen that quote?
No.
But that would be his loss, right? The loss.
Yeah.
Interesting you find that funny. But
yeah, I find it very funny.
I've been meditating on that since I read it in 68. Way back then, he said, I'm making new commandments.
Well, if you have that story or quotation or something from Newsweek, I'd very much like to see it.
Yeah, I'll have to check that. I can. Mm-hmm. I've got to put my letters back in the late 60s folder, so I'll be near the 68 folder. It won't be a problem to look
okay,
it up.
Good. Uh-huh.
So let's end there.
I thought you said 78 before. Is it 68 or 78?
Yeah, no, 68. He's in.
Okay, good.
He's in Newsweek in the summer for the Dew Line or for some other reason. It's in that period where he seems to be saying we're making commandments. He also said in there, he said we're doing something. Since everybody else is doing it, we're just going along with it.
Yeah.
He acted very passive, you know, going with the flow. And see, if you look at, I read somebody writing on McLuhan, it's so pitiful because they're trying to pin him down and they don't get the process. You got to begin by saying, well, look, this guy is drifting and he's miming it for you. Here's back at you. And that's what you have to basically back then. McLuhan, if you said this and understood it, you'd say the guy is insane. But everybody's become like that. So it's not so insane. It's prophetic. Yet the book dictates the error. Each medium dictates the error of style. Nobody gets the medium, what you should do in the medium, correctly. Because the medium dictates. So you're actually doing what the medium requires. You know, you write a book, you have to have a point of view. That's what a book evokes. But you have to write a book to counter that effect. You have to illustrate that you're aware of that effect and you're going to try to counter it. So, okay, buddy, I'm selling you a book. It's the wrong medium for our time, but it's all you have time to do. So here it is, and I will illustrate how completely inadequate you are in engaging my book.
Yeah. But I will accept your $22.95.
as a repentance or some kind of penitent fee, right? It's a tithe. And that's where we're at. So I come back. Trump was always the closest to expressing this. His presidency was exactly the absurdity I just laid out. And it's all it could be. Because how could you be president anymore? It's so obsolete that you had to be non-presidential just to make it look potentially real.
Since the office had completely changed, then the office holder had to be completely changed.
And that's, we're not sure, we probably changed again, but we're not sure how to do it after Trump.
Oh, for sure not. Yeah. No, the cul-de-sac is consolidated more than ever.
Yeah.
So, of course, it's completely opaque.
So Trump is...
But we should...
We get to end, I know.
Yeah, but that's a good place to end because it's a great place to start.
Yes, and I'm saying that to update McLuhan, my book nails it. I go for the right phenomenon, the correct phenomenon, Trump. You've got to deal with Trump. You know what I mean?
Well, I know what you mean, but that's too linear for me, Bob.
I know, but I'm just telling, I heard so many people in the McLuhan birthday celebration a year ago, the whole gang of them, the McLuhanites, and they're all, if the word Trump came up, they'd start to vomit or very dismissive. They had no way to write about or to discuss the phenomenon, and that showed their inadequacy. You've got to be able to talk about Trump in clinical terms, whatever the phrase would be, from a position of poise. not Trump derangement syndrome or whatever the other one is.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
I agree with that. Of course.
And I think McLuhan, you know, helps you get a handle on this. That guy who wrote the article on Trump, he had the thesis that Trump read McLuhan's Playboy interview when he was 23 in 1969. And it influenced him somehow, subliminally. Have you seen that essay? Did I send it to you?
I think so. That's the online thing,
yeah.
The blog Windows or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I read it.
Okay. If I get a chance to interview Trump, that's going to be my first question. Did you read the Playboy interview? Do you remember it? 1969, March issue. That's going to be my first question.
All right, good.
But that's what I always do. As soon as I can, I'll bring up McLuhan or one of my other holy offices to see, to gauge. It's my way of being an Eskimo, to gauge where the environment's at.
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent.
So, let's start. We'll we're on page 175.
Yeah.
We'll make a point of starting there.
Yeah, I think you're right. That it's good to go to defining Trump rather than running through the script. Okay. I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Cameron.
Ciao.
Bye.
Bye-bye.